Apple TV Plus has now aired its final episode of the season for the show Shrinking. You'll want to know if it's worth your time. We'll talk about that. Then we'll do a check-in on the AMC series Lucky Hank, and our Perry Mason plot dissection will continue on this week's Taking It Down.
An elevator tape projection.
Hey, welcome to Taking It Down, the TV and movie podcast produced by the Alabama Take. I'm Blaine Duncan, editor-in-chief of the Alabama Take and one of the hosts for the show. Taking It Down's here because I thoroughly enjoy dissecting why I like what I like and why I dislike what I dislike when it comes to TV, movies, even books and music. I have an English degree and a side hustle as an English teacher, so I'll try my best to offer insight that you can use in conversation with others or with us. Luckily, my ideas aren't the only set of viewpoints on the podcast each week, because with me every week are these three. Adam Morrow, who's an erudite traveling and studio musician with a penchant for fine literature. Donovan Reinwald, a media specialist with encyclopedic knowledge on film and more. Plus, Natalie Morrow, the first person to ask about fantasy, sci-fi, comics, trashy reality TV, and Beyoncé's music. From us, you'll get the obvious and the obscure. We're here for the TV and film obsessed who are too busy for anything more than the show or movie itself. We'll give the outside of Hollywood analysis with zero Southern stereotype. Okay, here they are. You probably know him most for his dissection of music, particularly Boy Genius, on Twitter. It's Adam Morrow.
The discourse was inescapable this weekend.
Up next, you probably know him from his discourse on Boy Genius on Twitter. His name's Mr. Donovan Reinwald.
Great to be here, Blaine, but I'm staying away from that discourse.
Yeah, I just follow Donovan. That's what I mean by it. Under my feed.
Don't worry, guys. Before we aired this show, I checked on Pitchfork to see if they still like them. They still do.
Okay. Whew. Wipe my brow. Natalie Morrow is not with us this week, but you probably know her for her discourse on the band Boy Genius on Twitter. She'll be back around next week. Twitter's all abuzz about the band Boy Genius.
True.
You're not gonna hook me in that.
I can't bait either of you. I don't think the three of us, if we're being honest with listeners, we don't have an opinion. We just thought that the discourse was weird, fascinating, odd.
Realizing the discourse doesn't really always take place around the piece of art itself.
Yeah.
Like I think we texted about the fact that Phoebe Bridgers has been so big for this number of years now. The blowback has to happen eventually. Mm-hmm. Even though she's really not the one catching the most flack. Lucy Dacus's line really got one of her verses just got run through the mud on Twitter. I haven't actually listened to the record, by the way, so I'm going to not say anything about my thoughts.
No, yeah, exactly. I don't think any of us have. I've listened to three songs. What do I know? I don't know anything. I don't have an opinion one way or the other. It's just Twitter went crazy Friday.
Did you like that first EP they did?
I don't know that I listened to it enough. It's I liked Phoebe's Punisher album quite a bit, and out of the three of them, that's about the most I know.
I like Lucy Dacus's first record. When that I Don't Want to Be Funny Anymore, when that song came out, it was definitely a who is this kind of moment. Like, this is spectacularly good for a first release. And then, you know, Julian Baker's been knocking around Memphis for a long time. He used to play a ton of house shows there, so seem like good folks.
They just need to stay off, get off of Leonard Cohen's back.
Yeah.
is that our stance?
I think that's our stance. He's dead now.
That's been reported.
You heard it here first, yeah. Folks.
Lucy Dacus also has a killer cover of Dancing in the Dark.
That one is really good.
That is pretty killer. Well, we don't have anything really to add. It's just an odd thing that's happening online, and we've been sharing links.
I can start some new discourse.
Well, okay.
How much better is the Lucy Dacus cover of Dancing in the Dark than the Jason Isbell cover
of
Dancing in the Dark?
I've never heard it. Don't want to. So, because Lucy Dacus has that, she's got that ground covered. Let's get into our first real topic. It's the Apple TV Plus series Shrinking.
Shrinkage?
No, just shrinking.
Shrinking. Like,
Donovan, I wasn't able to call it shrinking one time. Like, even when Natalie said, what are you guys going to talk about today? I was like, like, I was genuinely trying to remember what it, this is like a Stan Mullins.
This is, I was just about to
all
say.
All over again, where the joke becomes reality, except I could never remember shrinking. And it's, even then, shrinking, not shrinkage.
Anyway, this show, it's what it's called. But, you know, it's kind of a psychiatric head shrink kind of title. Stars Jason Segel as the parent of a teenage daughter, and both of them are grieving the loss of their wife and mother, respectively, in their own ways. On top of it, Segel's character, Jimmy, is a psychiatrist, which is the title. He works with a fellow psychiatrist, Paul, played by Harrison Ford, Gabby, played by Jessica Williams, and that's good enough for anyone who wants to watch it. That's that right there is all I needed, was just the cast. Harrison Ford doing only his second television show ever. And it's both of those
right,
have come within the last year. Right. No, both of those come within the last year. Man, this guy's, his late career act or whatever you want to call it, is he's full throttle. You know, he's filming with Marvel now, doing probably a couple of those movies. The guy has found a new gear at age 80. Is he 80?
I do agree with you that we need to enjoy Harrison Ford while we still have him.
Maybe that's his theory. He thinks they want me. Here I am. The kids want a puppet show. I'll give them a puppet show.
He is 80 years old.
If you have not watched Shrinking, we're going to be talking about the whole first season in case you want to skip to our next segment. Adam, you and Natalie binged it. What was it you loved about it? Because it wasn't just like I texted you one day and you haven't watched any, and then 5 weeks later, it was like overnight, you had sent me a message and you were halfway through referencing things that happened in like episode 6 or 7.
Well, you know, you baited the hook weeks ago when it first came out by saying that if you want to see Harrison Ford act like
Harrison
a
40.
Old man, yeah, Harrison 40 and chew people out. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like something I would be pretty into. So we intended to watch it all along. And then, you know, obviously I've been away traveling a bit. And so getting back, I think part of the reason that we binged it, one, the episodes are a bingeable length. Like, there's a lot of meat on the bone to every episode, but it's not a full 50-minute commitment. So that helps a lot. But it's also living in that Bill Lawrence world, which, you know, now that he has, maybe this is unfair. I mean, me and Donovan watched a ton of Scrubs when we were roommates in college. So we're familiar with the Bill Lawrence world. But now that he has not only done that, you know, he's done the Ted Lasso thing and now doing this. And, you know, dude has built, carved out kind of his own emotional universe that's pretty comfortable for me to live in. I'm not going to lie. Watching an episode of Ted Lasso makes me feel better than if I didn't watch that episode of Ted Lasso.
That's true.
And I think Shrinking, you know, even though it was a continent away from Ted Lasso and nothing to do with the Premier League, nothing to do with any of that, none of the same actors, it feels like an extension of that universe. I remember early on telling Nat when it went to the theme song on this one, if Marcus Mumford had started singing, I wouldn't have been surprised.
Would you take the Decemberists instead?
It's all Death Cab, right? Singing?
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it Death Cab?
Yeah, Ben
God
Gibbard.
God damn it. I can never tell the two apart, can I be honest?
They sound completely different.
They do sound.
You say that.
Different, but of a piece, I would say. They're
cut from the same cloth. Okay, different pieces of cloth, but...
But yeah, once we got it rolling, since we did wait until the last week, really, to watch it, yeah, it was tough to put it down. Really compelling show, great storylines. I thought the acting was top-notch. Bill Lawrence doing his Bill Lawrence thing.
And kind of funny sometimes.
Yeah, very funny throughout.
Yeah, Harrison Ford being the funniest, probably, right?
I think they were all pretty great.
Yeah. Him just bitching at every little thing, I was so on board with, you know, relatable content.
He probably wasn't even acting.
Yeah, no, he wasn't. Him. He was probably just, yeah, shut up. You know, that it was like, oh, leave that in.
The episode where a door opens on him entering a party at night with sunglasses on. That was it. That was spectacular.
It was very Ted Lasso in the sense that you mentioned when I watched it, I was happy I watched it. And I ended up watching, I think, every episode on Friday when it was released. So I never avoided it. Never even thought about avoiding it. I don't think it's as good as Ted Lasso, and I'm going to say why. I think that the stakes for this one are more grounded. You know, with Ted Lasso, you get that Premier League stuff, and you get relegation versus promotion, and that adds some spice to just Ted having to deal with his marital affairs, with dealing with the personalities on the club. And some of that, I think, just ropes you in a little more. With Shrinking, your focus was mainly on Jimmy, the character of Jimmy, whom I thought to be fairly funny, but sometimes Jimmy, just his character, just did not compare to what I wanted to see from Paul, the Harrison Ford character, and Gabby, the Jessica Williams character. In fact, when Paul started riding to work with Jessica Williams and they were singing with
Sugar Ray, right?
It was Sugar Ray every morning.
Natalie was just floating somewhere above Florence about the time that scene played. Specifically, as she was leaving today, she said, please mention the best scene in that show, which is, of course, in her mind, the Sugar Ray scene.
We have to add Harrison Ford very, very into it.
Asking for the song.
That's right. It starts with him saying, put that song back on. And it just... He's just got this grumpy dad thing going in that scene. You know, have you ever been in the car with a dad or grandfather who don't know the name of something and tell you to put it on?
Yeah, that's great.
Perfect. But I'll say that Jimmy's character, when he was funny, he was fine, but I just don't think it compared to when his character was earnestly dealing with his grief and the loss of his wife. I felt like Jason Segel was playing those even better than usual, and I didn't mind having those, and I wouldn't mind having more of that with Jimmy.
I thought he was really good. I thought Jason Segel plays a goofy but vulnerable guy so well. His comedy, I mean, he is a funny guy, but it comes from a much different place than a lot of the comedy in Ted Lasso, for sure. And you were talking about stakes. I think that's something that I enjoyed a lot about this world, is that it kind of was a celebration of just liking your suburban neighbors enough to like have them over for dinner a few times a week and wanting to hang out with your coworkers and kind of like very benign social things like that. You know, it isn't high stakes sports, or it isn't even living in like a cool neighborhood, like an urban neighborhood or anything like that. It was just, here are these people living life. Sidebar, I'm interested in your take on this. Apparently you make a lot of money if you're a mental health professional living in Pasadena, California. These people are living real well. And you can sometimes have maybe a penchant for not liking folks who have money. In fiction. You're kind of like, yeah, whatever.
Oh, not in fiction.
Oh, in real life too, but.
In real life and fiction sometimes, yeah.
It has been something that I've seen things that I liked, and you're like, well, they're just a bunch of rich assholes or something.
Yeah, no, I've been reading too much Engels and Marx.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you, but...
Oh, okay.
I just thought it was interesting, because this was a very, like, very, very upper middle class story.
It was, but it was presented in a way that we were supposed to believe that they're somewhat middle class. You know what I mean? Like,
I guess
their neighborhood in would have been much more affordable, regular Alabama town or Iowa or wherever. So just because they were in Pasadena didn't color me into thinking that they were rich that much. Yeah,
I mean, she drives a Tesla, right?
Yes, but he was driving like a 1975 Bronco or something that was just beat up.
Yeah, but it's kind of cool.
It was kind of cool. No, it didn't bother me. I didn't think anything about it. I think it's when the money is a factor into what they're doing.
Like giving their neighbor's pool house tenant $20,000 to start his food truck?
I don't know. Was that like their retirement money or something? They were doing an investment.
I guess. I mean, they did it pretty flippantly.
Kind of. But this was not a show that was going to belabor any one point too much, other than the death of the wife. which was a shadow over the entire 10 episodes. 8 episodes or 10 episodes? I mean, it breezed by.
It really did.
The grief of the wife was a shadow, and Paul's diagnosis of Parkinson's was the pall that was leveling out the comedy. But, you know, the opening scene of the entire series is Jason Segel's character partying with prostitutes and doing cocaine and Adderall. And I wanted to see more of that. I thought that that part kind of got glossed over. Like a full episode maybe was needed to see how he's been behaving badly. Because they come back around to that a little, and it just didn't feel as believable because his daughter Alice is disconnected herself from him, and she's like, you know, you've been an awful dad for a year, but it's, you have to think pretty hard, like, oh yeah, but he was only an awful dad for me, the viewer, for one scene.
Yeah, that was, so, I was gonna comment about for the stakes to have been lower and things weren't really accomplished in like a traditional sense, like there was no hero's quest or anything like that, like these characters traveled a long way.
Yeah,
they covered a lot of emotional ground, and I was thinking the most obvious example is that scene that starts it off, that when you think about it in the context of the full first season, feels terribly out of place. I mean, not like terrible, like it's a bad inclusion, but yeah, it's so, you get that one little brief glimpse of his dark year, and then it's off to the races with the healing process.
Which makes it feel weird that they didn't do a lot of hand-wringing on any plot points except for Alice just being, for the three-fourths of the season, Dad, I'm pissed off at you. I almost hate you. You know, because nothing else was drawn out. You felt like, man, shouldn't she should just probably... I mean, they're the only two left in the family. Seems like they get along okay. Why is she being still so standoffish toward him?
Yeah. I thought they did a pretty great job with Alice, and I am forgetting the actor's name who plays her. She was very good, and I thought that the way that they, I don't know, it seems like a lot of shows, movies, whatever, struggle to get both parent and child perspective in addition to doing other things, you know, in a pretty balanced way. It's where you understand not only like their conflict with each other, but like all the nuances of what's influencing how they approach each other. Like her confused feelings about, remind me of the patient's name who moves in.
Sean.
Her confused feelings about Sean, or the neighbor kid or any of that stuff. But also like, you know, her dad screwing things up in very similar ways. I don't know. I thought that was all pretty great.
There were a few small things that weren't as grounded or maybe realistic. I thought that the crush on Sean played oddly. I don't think that it was unrealistic, because that was probably a coping mechanism for her, but the way it played out, maybe her actions or the quick resolve, it was almost as if in the writer's room, they were writing week to week or something, and they saw it play out on film and decided, we need to get out of this as quick as we can.
Mm.
And that's the way it read to me. And the same thing about a couple of other things, where it was just like, let's put a bow on this and just move on, because it's not clicking the way we thought it would once we see it in the dailies or something.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought maybe they just understood that they had limited time to kind of sort those things out and needed the characters to go through, like, in the specific instance of Sean, like, the messy, cringy feelings of being a teenager, you know, and figuring things out, and am I an adult? Am I not an adult? That kind of like back and forth is happening. And it happens in very much, like, I kept thinking about her story compared to like Euphoria and what they're saying about being a teenager, you know?
Yeah.
Because she's clearly like a cool teenager, whatever, pretty smart, has had to go through these hardships, but is not running around doing Euphoria things, you know?
She is scoring candy for Paul.
She is doing that. Yeah.
I don't, that's not a euphemism. She's scoring literal candy.
Fun dip. When the fun dip episode, but then also, oh, maybe I should go find that guy who thought I went to USC and go back to his dorm or something. Like all of that kind of wrapped in one character was pretty good, while Dad is dealing with dead wife stuff. And I thought the slow reveal of his wife and him kind of working through all that stuff, I don't know, I thought it was really good, and it was very Bill Lawrence. You know, he does that there's the famous episode of Scrubs where Dr. Cox is really going through. Were you a Scrubs guy, Blaine? I can see your expression.
No, I wasn't. I didn't. I only watched like maybe an episode.
There's one episode of Scrubs that's pretty like TV famous.
Okay.
Legendary, even, that I feel like I shouldn't spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it, yourself included. But he does. Yeah. He's very good at how he reveals narrative information when he's looking for an emotional gut punch. Shrinking never did it quite to the degree that Scrubs did. But slowly getting to know his wife and like his questions about if he's remembering things the right way, or, you know, all those kind of things were really great, I thought.
Look back to Luke Tenney, that's the guy who played Sean, and back to things going week to week. I didn't think he held his own to about the fourth episode when his character got to drop the anger a little and become a more relaxed version. I was like, oh, now I believe Luke Tenney as that Sean. I didn't buy him as a PTSD vet that was quick to snap with anger.
Yeah, I didn't really either. And I don't know if that was performance or writing, but
performance or writing or getting to know the character, which is performance. Yeah, getting to grow.
I would agree that by the end of the show, I felt like I had been again on kind of a journey with him.
Yeah,
and thought that he did a great job, but it did take a minute to get there.
He did a great job from about episode 4 on. I would make the claim that Tenney's better when playing happy and carefree, and Jason Segel's better when he's doing wistful or melancholy.
Hmm.
It's not to say that the show's bad. I'm just giving what I saw. But who was note perfect? Yet again, Jessica Williams and Harrison Ford. Ford was perfectly cast and well-used. Who else does grumpy but heartfelt?
Yeah.
You know? And he's... I'll go so far to say that it might be his best performance, maybe ever.
Ever.
Maybe. What else would you put up against it? His performance in Working Girl from, what, 88, 89? I mean, because that was pretty good.
Oh, we're talking about Han Solo and Indiana Jones?
Yeah, I think
that's what I'm thinking here.
I'm not trying to be mean, but I think that any nice, halfway decent, rugged action star could play Han Solo. Indiana Jones, maybe only a couple, but still.
I disagree about Han Solo.
He wasn't tasked to play a guy with Parkinson's and having to face his daughter about it.
No, of course not. And it's different writing, it's a different time, different circumstances, everything. But, I mean, it's tough for me to say that's his best role ever when he plays like two completely iconic character.
Not best role, best performance.
Right.
Yeah.
Best performance. Sorry. Either way, I have trouble saying that's the best performance.
Gotcha.
It was very, very good.
Brett Goldstein involved too from Ted Lasso.
Was he? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he played a producer's role of some sort.
Okay.
Maybe even writing some. He, of course, being Roy Kent.
He's here. He's there. He's every fucking where.
I did like the show Shrinking, its take on grief and how relationships are devices to a degree to resolve grief, you know, to move overhead that it's community and it's friendship to help with that.
I thought that was what was so beautifully done about it. I thought part of Sean, the strength of Sean's arc was that when he found this little community, he took to it so quickly. And that felt very believable to me, that someone in his position would want the kind of almost like boring, vanilla, you know, suburban folks to hang out with.
White.
Yeah. And that they love spending time together and drinking in their backyards and, you know, just, again, doing pretty boring stuff, but it's because they're together that it has value. And that's not like something that's portrayed a lot in big TV shows, or I feel like you're like searching right now to prove
in dramedies.
Yeah.
Not so much in dramedy. You see it in sitcoms and it's more flippant and less grounded probably.
Right. I think the weight that they were able to add to it, it was almost like a sitcom set up for like one of those shows that somehow is on ABC, CBS, whatever, in the middle of the week that a gabillion people watch, yet I don't know anyone who watches, you know?
yeah.
But it had that weight to it that it's like, oh, this, they're actually really saying something about family, about friendship, about what's important in life.
One example of the show and its love for its own characters was, in a good way, I mean, is Derek, the husband next door. He was often the butt of the joke, but he was never angry about it or bitter. He was okay with it and in on it a lot of times, you know. And he had got a couple of moments toward the end to shine. That guy who plays him was also in, like, Revenge of the Nerds or something. He's a known actor for years. But, you know, when he retires and he offers his wife to walk to the mailbox, I don't know. It's kind of funny, but it's also kind of sweet.
Also loved the joke that he has a ton of friends and is very popular, but like we're only seeing like the people who don't have the ability to hang out with anybody else all hanging out with each other, and then he's actually like the real socialite, the cool guy,
mm-hmm. and they don't even know his name some of the time.
Yeah, but that was great.
So Gabby and Jimmy, should they be a couple or not? That was our semi cliffhanger.
Before they hooked up, I was like, well, obviously they're probably going to hook up at some point.
I thought so too.
This season, when it happened, I thought that happened very quickly. We'll see.
It's a good show, though. Good Apple TV Plus show, another one from them. They're really knocking it out of the park.
Apparently, they have two more seasons of this. This is a hard-planned thing, almost like a Breaking Bad. Like, this is how many episodes I need to tell the story.
Also, like Ted Lasso, right? They're doing three, and that's it.
Apparently the understanding, but this is like Bill Lawrence has said out loud, we're only doing three seasons of this.
Interesting. Let's take a break and we'll do Perry Mason, Little Lucky Hank. Of course, Taking On Sports, the Alabama Takes Premier Sports podcast, has a heavy Alabama lean. That's what you want, but there's some serious objectivity too. Join hosts TD and Greg every other Monday as they recap and break down the biggest news in college sports and beyond. Find it by searching Taking On Sports, minus the G, or head directly to the Alabama Take to stream it every other Monday. Okay, let's get back into the HBO show Perry Mason and unravel some of this fourth episode titled Chapter 12. It had a subtitle, which I forgot or didn't see. One of those two happened. Anyway, but it's the second season, so it's Chapter 12, even though it's the fourth episode. Spoilers are ahead. A quick recap is that Perry and Della took some time off for a weekend while Paul is bothered and nagged by the investigation and the fact that the Galero men definitely rented a gun and used it somehow or another. And Drake now has that gun. There's Holcomb, the crooked policeman, interrogating a produce worker who was also the same man attacked by the McCutcheon father. And then at the very end, there's money under a car. So, whoa, what a show. I have an idea that this show wants me to piece some things together, which is the Gallardo men were training with guns to practice killing Brooks because they were paid by the McCutcheon father.
Oh, you think so?
I think that's kind of sort of what I'm...
still the payoff?
I think that... Well, no, I don't know if that's what I'm... That's probably not what's going to happen, but I think that's what I'm supposed to be thinking right now. Right. The stash of cash found at the end of the episode was by Sophia Gallardo, and she was given a set of drawings to lead her there from her husband in jail. So it makes sense that that's the money they were going to get. Or maybe they're supposed to take the fall for this, and maybe they didn't kill. It's one of those two things. But my task for you, connect the catatonic Lawson girl in the hospital, her brother, the councilman, and Goldstein, the produce guy, whom I don't even think we've seen on screen.
No.
And the grocer, played by Sean Austin, to the murder. Where do those lines of plot come in?
You know, Perry was ready to do it. He had his map out. You know, he was, what's the guy, King of the 7th District or whatever? He's like, it all fits together, and then Paul goes and ruins his buzz.
Yeah.
I don't know that. So obviously the catatonic girl, the city councilman, and whatever shady deal Brooks was pulling with the produce guy are going to come into it somehow.
Yeah.
I don't know that the Sean Austin grocer is going to be, he might just be a plot device to be like, hey, here's how they can afford this.
Here's the money.
Yeah.
Well, did the Galero boys do it, or were they coerced to take the fall with the money?
That's the $1 million question, isn't it?
Right.
I really like the way Matthew Reese played it when he believes they've done it and he's ready to walk on them.
Mm-hmm. He had that thing, same thing he did in The Americans. He could turn on scary a little.
Yeah.
And that was real cool because he was pretty vicious at saying, I'm not going to defend you anymore. I'm leaving right now.
The word that popped into my head, and this is probably too strong a word, but he's good at playing like he's a little unhinged. Like he might do just about anything. You're not sure what he's going to do next.
A little bit. That's true. Especially in that scene. You know, if you like dramas, that's the kind of scene that has you on the edge of your seat.
Mm-hmm.
You're wondering, what direction is this going to go in?
I like that they have the character-driven drama part where it's like, we're invested in Perry. We want to know what's happening. We know, and they also have the mystery that's gotten pretty good. Like, yes. I'm genuinely interested in the solution to the mystery. And I'm genuinely interested in what's going to happen with Perry and his friends.
All of that. What's on the ships that Brooks was getting from the produce people? Because the idea is that you don't get produce from a ship because California's got enough during that time period. My mind immediately went to human trafficking, but that, I don't know if... that doesn't quite jihad either.
Some kind of smuggling, definitely, right?
Yeah. Maybe just drugs or something.
Who knows? Now, how the what's your face hooks into all that? The produce thing and the catatonic girl. Obviously, the Venn diagram there is Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
But how they tie together? I'm curious to see if the show will be able to pull it off.
Mm-hmm. Other than just Brooks put her in that state somehow or another.
Right.
Yeah. Did you notice this episode very adeptly? Spent the first maybe 15 whole minutes without any sign of Perry Mason.
Yeah.
I thought it was so cool. Paul Drake and Della Street are interesting on their own, and I thought that was proof right there.
I agree. I really liked, I don't know, I like the guy that plays Paul. I like all the actors, but I like the guy who plays Paul, and I like how he was kind of wrestling with what to do.
Mm-hmm. Chris Chalk is his name.
Yeah, and the way he's like, do I tell Perry because it's so that he doesn't get ambushed in court? And destroy his confidence in these men, or do I let him continue to think they're innocent and defend them? And he played conflicted very well.
Very. He uses his wife as a best friend sounding board, mm-hmm. besides just wife figure, and that's kind of cool. I don't think it's going to play out on the show, but I did think immediately that Perry took his son horseback riding because he knew the teacher would be there. You know, Perry's the kind of guy who would know things if but maybe he's too busy with the case to figure out the teacher working on Saturdays kind of thing, but...
He definitely, I think, is wrapped up in the case. I think it's just a meet cute.
Yeah, it was. Nina, one thing that I found, the show does have a slip or two here and there, and they're so small. The one slip is that I didn't understand why he came into the school, barged into the school pretty angry, to pick his son up. It's like, let's go. And he didn't even have the beat of, hey, come on, let's go. It's time to go. It was just immediate anger. I didn't pick up on why he came bursting in angry.
I think that we were supposed to connect the dots with, like, his name's being raked through the mud. He's got all this stuff going on. He's mad at the brothers. And just kind of like, oh, that's why he's mad. And understand that.
But, was that the night...
I don't think they connected the dots. I agree with you that they didn't connect the dots super well.
Was it after the night he broke into the stables and rode the horse, or was that... Where did that fall in the episode?
Because
was he supposed to be hungover and, like, tired? And
I think he did do it after the stables, didn't he?
I'm not sure, but
I don't remember either.
You know, he's got some impulsivity to him where he's just like, fuck it, I'm going to go ride that horse.
I'm going to ride a champion thoroughbred.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it might have been in Vulture this week where I initially questioned why a teacher would be so defensive and willing to go hang out with a guy who is impulsive and a bit quick to anger. But, you know what? It could be that she's attracted to him because of that.
Yeah. And I think we can see that, right? Because, like, maybe she's attracted to him for the same reason that we as a viewer are kind of attracted to watching him.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, she might have.
Interesting.
He's interesting, but she might have saw him as somebody who defends himself, doesn't take any shit, which that's saying something about masculinity in the show. But maybe the time period is a more accurate.
I do think that, you know, this is not what they care about or what they're focusing on. But we do kind of have two contrasting pictures of masculinity with Paul, who is able to be honest and open with his wife. And she helps him out. And then Perry, who is so closed off, he can't even be honest with Della.
They're right. That's a good point, too. Did Jeannie and Perry jump into a relationship, seems like it, too quickly?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, too quickly realistically, yes, but too quickly for the show?
It was pretty speedy.
It's pretty speedy. Pretty speedy.
Because it happened in about 1.5 episodes.
Yeah, it really did. Della has a brunch with Miss Nygaard, who, and Miss Nygaard, she's not a Perry Mason fan. She says he's too impulsive. She implies that Della's the better professional. The Nygaard lady's opinions about Perry, is she saying this to hinder the defense and the investigation? Or is she saying it because she's attracted to Della? Or is it both?
Right. I don't know.
Yeah.
And you know, like everything else, not like everything else, but there's an element of truth in what she says. You know, like often it's Della who's saving Perry by finding the legal precedent and all that. And so, but yeah, is she planting that seed of doubt to deliberately derail? Or is it, I'm looking out for you, we're both, you know, tough, independent women, or is something else going on?
Right. Is it romantic, romantically linked? Good dialogue writing when Miss Nygaard does say, he's been in the trenches too long, and there's like a pause where she clears up, not war trenches, but we all, you know, it's just a little nudge to viewers like, remember, he's in the war, or was in the war.
He's a vet.
Such a huge personality trait for him, for anyone at that time.
This is something that, another little thing I was wondering about, that the show, and this is, but doesn't Della have a partner?
Yeah, and you know, we mentioned it last week, she's just been pushed.
MIA?
It's time for her to show up and say, what are you doing venturing off with this screenwriting lady?
Well, that's what I'm thinking, because Della's staying out overnight, you know, she's not coming home, she's, you know, she's doing all this stuff, and it's like, does she ever, she doesn't even, like, we don't even get like a phone call where she's like, I'll be back late.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that hit the editing room floor. There's a strong sense writers and showrunners want to still enjoy using this show to mirror a bit of our world in today's. We get the blusterous radio guy coming in to degrade Perry. I thought that was a pretty good wink and nod to us again.
What'd they call him, Maggot Mason?
Yeah. He even had another
he had a couple more.
Yeah. My bet is that the Galaro boys took money to take the fall, but there's a lot more to it. I still can't quite piece together anything else. That's just my bet.
I do think, and we'll see if I'm wrong, because maybe the show will really throw me a curveball. I think they're innocent. I think they're being railroaded. But I think there's more to the story.
Yeah. Can't wait to find out.
I know. It's kind of become like a fun, like it's fun that it's on a Monday night because I get like something to look forward to. I don't watch on Monday nights. I watch it on Tuesdays usually. But it's
sometimes
like,
I do, yeah.
Yeah. Got this to look forward to. Like
for
a
real.
Fun, yeah.
And once again, you just sink into the setting. You just.
They do. Whoever's doing their, like. I mean, it's very, like. Their set design and stuff.
Yeah.
Is great.
Their outdoor set design is fantastic. Paul's house is the only. Or it's not even his house. It's his brother's house or something. Their house does sort of look like a set every now and again, but the rest of it. especially outdoors, is just good.
With Paul's house, I honestly assumed that it was because it was a prefab.
Yeah, there is that notion. All right, we do have one last show to talk about. It's the Bob Odenkirk-led AMC series, Lucky Hank. We'll talk about and spoil the second episode, so just heads up if you haven't seen it either. That second episode's called George Saunders, because the guest on Hank's campus is none other than a very fictionalized George Saunders. Hank's tasked to interview him on stage for a writer's talk at the college, and that's not sitting well with Hank because they've known each other for years and years, and their paths went in different directions, Saunders being successful, Hank's floundering just as a professor and only having written the one book, and inability to write a follow-up novel. Quick check-in with this. Did you like episode 2 better or worse than the first?
Ooh, that's a good question, because I was thinking about what I was going to say about episode 2. I kept kind of coming back to, I don't know that I have anything to say that really extends or modifies my initial impression of the show, which is to say that I liked the episode.
Yeah.
I like the dynamics of the English department. I like how they're all in hell with each other. I like little things like Bardo's sign. That's like, what is it? Like 28 days without an apology or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, there were little touches that I liked, and I really, really like Bob Odenkirk in this role.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I have anything new to say, and I don't know that if you didn't like the first episode, I don't think this one's going to change your mind. And if you did like it, well, you kind of got more of the same.
Right. I was ambivalent or indifferent is not the adjective I need to go with. I was fine with everything until the last 15 minutes where George Saunders tells Hank before going on stage, and it seemed sincere, that, hey, I did love your initial book. I really do want you to write another one. And then Hank's response to that as he was walking out to the car with his wife, something about those two scenes made me like the episode more than the first one. It seemed very heartfelt.
Yeah, there was... I was wondering how that sat with you, because there's almost like a triumphant moment in it where, where Hank is able to go out and like he actually like nails the discussion, and they kind of play it with like, you know, uplifting music over it and
the montage.
Yeah, and I was wondering, like, did that? And I was kind of honestly a little bit the whole time waiting for the other shoe to drop, like how's he gonna mess it up?
Yes,
but it seemed to be sincere. Like,
yeah,
does that fit with the rest of the show for you?
That's what I was wondering, because it felt like a bit of a resolution, and that means next week they're going to have to undo the resolution and start all over with Hank being frustrated again.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I can tolerate that week to week where he'd say, start with a problem. I mean, that would be very episodic for a show that's maybe not episodic, not to my knowledge.
No. And I agree with you. I think, at least for the first two episodes, I might be reading too much into it, but we are supposed to see a guy who's on kind of on a slow burn breakdown.
Right.
And if he's having a resolution and then having it undone every week,
yeah,
that completely counteracts that.
It does. I'm not so sure that this show really wants to be overtly tame. I don't know if they're... I think one of the showrunners or head writers is Toby from The Office, the guy who plays Toby from The Office.
Oh, really?
And there
That's
is
interesting.
A, yeah, and there is a bit of sitcom, network sitcom feel to this in a sort of a bad way. You know, how things get fixed at the end of the sitcom, and then next week there's the situation, and it's got to be, you know, that.
Kind of the thing Seinfeld was responding to, right? Like, no crying, no learning, no hugging.
Right. I just feel like this show was sold to me as a bunch of self-loathing and its repercussions, and I'm not seeing enough of that, which is a weird thing to say about a television show.
And we'll this is where I'm kind of willing to give the show some leash, because at least I'm reading into it. I do see it as a slow burn, unless they completely mess that up. Mm-hmm. So I'm willing to watch Lucky Hank get even luckier.
Or unluckier. There is one thing I thought reverberated with me. One thing reverberated with me, and that's this small idea from a short scene from Hank's sudden appearance from his mom. her appearance felt a little sudden, but I suppose not. Which is
she'd kind of been hinted at.
That's right. That's right. She basically says, in a paraphrase, you can be good at writing or you can be a good dad, but you can't be both.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, was a good idea, too. Someone once told me that you can be a good high school football coach or you can be a good high school teacher, but you can't be both.
And yeah, that makes sense. Like, it's one of Hank's justifications for not writing, but it's also might have the advantage of being true, right? Like, he's like, I was here, I was a father, I was engaged, I wasn't writing.
Yeah.
And, you know, his own dad, who was clearly writing, was a terrible father.
Exactly. It does also remind me of Harrison Scott Key. Are you familiar with the author, Harrison Scott Key?
I don't think so.
So he has a very cool and funny video. It's a TED Talk, I think, where he claims you can have three of these things, but that's it. He calls it the American Dream Value Meal, or the American Value Meal. And he says you can have three of these, but he lists all family, friends, fun, fitness, financing, and the American Dream. You can have three of those at any one time, but you can't. And you can swap out and do the other one, but you got to eliminate one of the others. I just love that. And that seems to be a bit of what Hank's expressing in the midpoint of this episode, where he's talking to his mom and then his wife.
Yeah.
Which his wife is really just another mother figure for him.
I know. She puts up with it. Well, I guess his mom doesn't put up with it too much. But, like, I do like that his wife really doesn't put up with it. She's like, stop being self-pitying.
Yeah. And I noticed somewhere online this week where it's billed as a dark comedy. And so I thought, oh, okay, so that might be a bit of my problem with this show, is that there isn't enough darkness in the comedy. It's probably just a dramedy. If that you had to label it something to sell it. The conflicts they're fairly simple, I think, right now.
Yeah.
The midlife crisis doesn't feel like a crisis yet. It just feels midlife.
Yes. And maybe it will get more over the top, but it's not over the top yet. It's silly. And it's kind of real life cranked up to 11, especially with the interactions between the English department members. But it's still somewhat grounded.
Mm-hmm. Hank almost accepts mediocrity in that last bit where he gets into the car with his wife. And there was something comforting about that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have to walk it back, though.
Yeah, he's not... We've got more episodes of the series. He can't find peace. Yeah.
But there are only 8 this season.
Right.
So we're 2 of 8. So if it's going to be a slow burn, I don't know if they have time for it.
Start sizzling.
Yeah, for real. Definitely, though, I want to see it, and I want to watch it. And plus, we didn't even get the Kyle MacLachlan appearance this week.
No.
You know?
I can't wait for that.
That might boost some stakes for us. All right, people, that's the end of it. You can join us online. We have a Facebook group for Continuing the Talk. You can tell us what you think. Follow both our podcast online as well as the home site, The Alabama Take. We'll be back next week and hope you will too. Talk to you later.